Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today, we'll look at a number of subjects in the news, and we'll first go to Washington, D.C., and examine the parting words from George W. Bush with his most prescient chronicler, and look ahead to the new occupant who moves into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue on Tuesday. We'll be joined by Ron Suskin, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist whose coverage and analysis of the Bush administration has been acclaimed for its unique insight. Ron Suskin is the author of a number of books, including the bestsellers The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, The White House, and The Education of Paul O'Neill, and The 1% Doctrine. His latest book is The Way of the World, and we'll be talking to him in a moment. And then we will, since the Afghan war becomes Obama's war this Tuesday, we'll be joined by Alexander Thier, who is a senior advisor in the Rule of Law Project at the United States Institute of Peace. He's the director of the Future of Afghanistan Project and the senior rule of law advisor at the USIP, where he co-chairs both the Afghanistan and the Pakistan working groups. And Alexander Thier was a member of the Afghanistan study group, co-chaired by General James Jones and Ambassador Thomas Pickering, and was a member of the Pakistan Policy Working Group. Thier is also the director of the Project on Constitution Making, Peace Building, and National Reconciliation, and a leader of the expert group on the Genocide Prevention Task Force, co-chaired by Madeleine Albright and William Cohen. And then we will address the carnage in Gaza in terms of the exaggerated role of Iran, which is often erroneously referred to as the main sponsor of Hamas. We'll be joined by Dr. Trita Parsi, who's the president and founder of the National Iranian American Council, whose writing has appeared in numerous publications, including The Guardian, Haaretz, The Forward, Huffington Post, and The Nation. Dr. Trita Parsi worked for the Swedish permanent mission at the United Nations in New York, where he served on the Security Council and handled affairs for Afghanistan, Iraq, Tajikistan, and Western Sahara. He also served in the General Assembly's Third Committee addressing human rights in Iran, Afghanistan, Myanmar, and Iraq. His most recent book is Treacherous Alliances, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. I'm now speaking with Ron Suskin, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist, whose coverage and analysis of the Bush administration has been acclaimed for its unique insight. Suskin is the author of a number of books, including the bestsellers The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, The White House, and The Education of Paul O'Neill, and The 1% Doctrine. His latest book is The Way of the World. And clearly, Ron, you're out celebrating with all of the Washingtonians, including the millions of American citizens who've come into town for the festivities preceding this inauguration on Tuesday. And I'm sort of loath to talk a little bit about the fellow that's going out the door, but he did have some parting words this week. And to my mind, I found him diminished himself even further, if that's possible. That many of what he said, in fact, the crux of what he said, was sort of delusional at best and irrelevant. He said that you mightn't like the decisions he made, but he made the tough decisions. It's a totally meaningless statement. I mean, presidents are supposed to make tough decisions.
Well, you know, the whole idea is that every decision that gets to the Oval Office is by definition a tough decision. The question is, what do you do then? Presidents, I think, most of the presidents in modern times have said, oh my goodness, let me just make sure I don't make a mistake. If you make a mistake at that level, the consequences are almost beyond measure, so they stay up late. They call in advisors, often with competing voices, make sure that they, you know, don't screw up, frankly. This Bush seemed to have always been unencumbered by those very, very reasonable hesitations, and also the sense of stewardship. You know, he went with his gut. You know, essentially he ruled the world for 8 years based on instinct from inside of a bubble that, you know, was in some ways of his own crafting. You know, I think that it's extraordinary to see him at the finish, seemingly devoid of self-knowledge, that the reality-based community and reality-based events, as I've been talking about for years, ever since being a part of the coining of that phrase, seem to have not gotten into his pores. At the end, he's full of denial and bluster and bombast and I'm right and the rest of you, well, you know, you can go whatever way you want. I thought it was an extraordinary finish, especially, actually, in light of what Cheney was doing at the end, which is admitting, well, more or less almost everything I've had in my three books, saying, okay, fine. Well, people believe that, and understandably so. So I'll admit that those things are true, Cheney's saying, so come at me. Let's have it out. And have it out, essentially, in the long argument of history that's going to follow this administration. Bush, meanwhile, is sticking to the old, tired scripts, tattered and ready to be discarded long ago, saying, you know, and what's your problem? You know, so I'm disappointed that some things didn't work out. I did what I thought was right. It's extraordinary. Denial, I think, is a powerful force. People know that. But when it is so central to the definition of the world's most famous individual who has guided our ship of state and right to the very end, Bush never evolved. Other presidents, almost to a one, managed to evolve under the acute pressures of that office. Bush never evolved in office, so that he's making the same kinds of mistakes, really mistakes of character, that he made at the start and in the middle, he's making at the finish.
Well, I'm surprised that the press, you know, who haven't really nailed him and pinned him down on very much at all in these 8 years, in these final interviews, for example, when he says his only mistake, or the one that he cited, was the mission accomplished banner. I mean, that is such a fraudulent excuse, because at the time that they put that banner up, he actually believed that it was mission accomplished. I mean, in retrospect, it became a mistake, but at the time, it certainly wasn't a mistake, and landing on that aircraft carrier, he surely didn't think was a mistake either.
Well, he's talking about mistakes of image and perceptions and tactics, very, very thin tactics, frankly, instead of fundamental mistakes, fundamental mistakes of judgment, of decision-making. And frankly, at the end of the day, I think that what we see here is, you know, awfully and in its essence, that Bush is a person of weak character. I hate to even use that word, but his basic architecture was unsuitable to the challenges that confronted him as president. And as I said, by virtue of the kind of Oedipal lock he has always been in, it's about me and my father, my dad and me, what he did, what I'll do, you know, finishing his business, what he did wrong, I'll do right, all that stuff. You know, well, in a way, it's not about that. That's one of the oddities of having a father-son presidency, is that these family dynamics, what I call Oedipal Rex, W-R-E-C-K-S, end up being defining of this presidency in ways, of course, that would never happen for other presidents who are not sort of similarly engaged familially. But beyond that, Bush thought it was about him. His dilemmas, his issues with his dad, his gut, his instincts, his faith. It's not about you. It's about this office you inhabit for a fairly short period of time, even 8 years, guiding the ship of state of the world's most powerful nation. Other presidents got that. They often, going out of the office, expressed genuine humility at the awesome responsibilities and how they did their best to match up. Often they'll admit mistakes, you know, to say, here's what my successor ought to know that I learned, often the hard way. Bush has done none of that.
Well, Ron Suskin, he obviously defines his presidency in terms of 9/11, but to me the great irony of these 8 years has been that in spite of all of the fear-mongering about external enemies, whether it's Russia, Venezuela, Cuba, Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, you name it, at the end of the day, the people who really did damage to these United States are Americans, only a few thousand of them on Wall Street, who impoverished this country and the world. And they were enabled clearly by the Bush administration. So are we going to have a reckoning here about who really has hurt America?
Yeah, well, I certainly think that people are going to start doing more of what they're already sort of beginning at this juncture, which is to say, now, who got us into this mess as a way of not just accountability, to establish accountability, but to look at the hard truths and thereby maybe hard lessons to be learned. What did we do wrong here? What do we need to change to start moving in a different direction? And that will demand structural changes in much of the way America's public and private sectors operate. We've been moving on a kind of I'll buy it today and I'll pay tomorrow kind of model. You know, just keep the ball rolling. By the time they figure it out, we'll be on to the next thing. You know, continue to fuel momentum. Don't worry about transparency, accountability, your old virtues that really are part of the American firmament, prudence, a kind of ardor and honesty, a view that essentially there is no free lunch, so don't expect one. All of those things sort of got thrown over the edge of the ship, not just by Bush, but over several decades, when the United States, essentially as the world's lone superpower after the Soviet Union vanishes in the early 1990s, our old foe, in a way we started to believe our press clippings, and in both in foreign and domestic affairs, we moved with a kind of almost reckless headlong abandon, with two bubbles, the internet bubble, the real estate bubble, with a deepening debt, with a kind of buy today, pay tomorrow, just make sure I remember what my lawyer told me I can get away with kind of model. That's not really what built the country. The country was built under prudence, often a kind of village smithies understanding of measured beat and slow, of being clear that I will earn my way, and that I will not hear the siren songs of what I can get away with, and let's worry about cleaning up the mess tomorrow. I think right now the country is feeling the urge to restore and rely in its day-to-day activities on those American ideals and values that have been longstanding.
And Ron Suskin, I take it you're expecting some of this narrative in Tuesday's address by the new president. Clearly, the lack of accountability and the stuff that we've been talking about earlier, again, you know, you feel that you're beating a dead horse here, and that this is a moment in time when people are genuinely celebrating hope and change. And at the same time, tempered by the realization that this new president, for all of his skills, is being handed the worst possible mess on a plate.
Well, you know, it's true, and but I think that people are, in a way, well along in the correction. I think part of it was the election of Obama. You know, the miracle of democracy is not just its basic architecture, but its self-correcting processes, the way in which this ship of state gets put back on course by virtue of people recognizing with their Native American common sense that, boy, this is not the direction we want to be in, and how do we get back on course? And I think Obama's election, at least in significant ways, both in terms of the current issues and dilemmas, but the long historical journey as well, an African-American stepping up to the world's most august office, to the parapet of the leader of this nation, it'll be an extraordinary few years to come. Obama has a lot on the plate. I think one of the things that's important, though, that I think his folks do recognize, I hope they do, is that he can't step back from the thing that he does so very well, which is inspire people, which is to give them context, to say, you know, look, we have a lot that we're facing, but hope is a powerful force, and I'm going to manage hope with great care, and I will fuel hope with a clear reckoning, an understanding, and a framing of what does make this nation exceptional. You know, at the end of The Way of the World, which my latest book, which is really about what individuals can do to to reassert leadership in their own country. You know, there's a line where I talk about the failure of imagination, that the 9/11 Commission, of course, says it was a failure of imagination that was at fault. We failed to imagine the malevolence and ingenuity of our enemies. I think now as well, though, the great challenge, the great dilemma and vulnerability is a failure to imagine the nation America might yet become, the nation that those around the world say, be who we've imagined you to be. We need you more than ever now to be that nation. I think Obama gets that. I think part of his ascendance is part of a yearning for us to, in a way, imagine ourselves with a kind of clarity that is in the American tradition. I think that that's why it'll be an interesting time in the years ahead to show the power of how Obama helps people imagine and reimagine America. And I think that's really the key to getting through so many of the problems. So it all starts on a speech on Tuesday, and I'm sure it'll be one hell of a speech. I mean, Obama's got real chops.
Well, Ron Suskin, do you think that in this speech there will be some reference to a kind of renewed social contract? I mean, to some extent, we've been operating without a social contract in this country since perhaps after World War II. There was that The Best Years of Our Lives, that classic movie. There was a sense of a social contract, the GI Bill, etc. We're all in it together. And then clearly the Reagan years reversed that when people stopped saving and they maintained their standard of living via credit. And now that's all coming to a crunch. And you get the feeling that in many ways to inspire people is to remind them of this community called America, as opposed to what Bush and company have done, which is this cynical jingoism and hollow patriotism of flag waving and lapels, flags, etc.
Yeah, well, you know, look, Madison in Federalist 51 calls it the violence of factions, that the country can give way, he fears, to factionalism if there is not a sufficient ardor, a sufficient kind of energy applied to national leadership. And I think that Obama certainly has the opportunity, and I think he may well seize it, to restore a different ideal as to shared interest in America, a shared interest in terms of so many problems that are shared or certainly interconnected across the many kingdoms, the many nations and colors within America. I think that's part of what Obama has the chance to do as a character who, you know, by his basic ontological makeup and by his journey, has a kind of healing credibility to say, I'm a person who can walk across many borders in this country and can try to restore, this is important, a shared national narrative of who we are. That's the key, I think. You know, I think over the years, over the decades, we've lost sense of that shared narrative. It's become cacophonous and often one of conflict. And I think right now, with so much that we face, Obama might well, with people shocked into a stop-and-think moment, help to restore and revive and recast this notion of shared national purpose. And that's certainly, what I think a lot of people are hoping for.
Well, Ron Suskin, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles. And I look forward to your next book, which I imagine there's a certain pleasure in being able to write about a better subject.
Well, I think all I can say, Ian, is the next book will almost certainly be more hopeful than the ones that have preceded it. Let's just leave it at that.
Okay. Again, I've been speaking with Ron Suskin, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist whose coverage and analysis of the Bush administration has been acclaimed for its unique insight. He's the author of a number of books, including the bestsellers The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, The White House, and The Education of Paul O'Neill, The 1% Doctrine, and his latest book, The Way of the World. Let's now go to the subject of Afghanistan, since, as I mentioned, this Tuesday, Afghanistan becomes Obama's war. I'm speaking with Alexander Thier, who is the director of the Future of Afghanistan Project and senior rule of law advisor at the United States Institute of Peace, where he co-chairs both the Afghanistan and Pakistan working groups. Thier was a member of the Afghanistan Study Group, co-chaired by General James Jones and Ambassador Thomas Pickering, and was a member of the Pakistan Policy Working Group. Thier is also the director of the Project on Constitution Making, Peace Building, and National Reconciliation, and an expert group led on the Genocide Prevention Task Force, co-chaired by Madeleine Albright and William Cohen. And Alexander Thier, just this week, the Afghan war becomes Obama's war. What do you make of what Hillary Clinton mentioned in her confirmation of the more for more strategy?
Well, I think that this change of administration represents an opportunity for a critical juncture in our Afghanistan strategy. We have been in Afghanistan for 7 years now, and the last 3 years have seen a fairly grave deterioration, both in terms of security, the rise of the insurgency, as well as the confidence of the Afghan population in the government and in the international community. And this is a big moment to reflect on what we're doing in Afghanistan and how we're approaching it. And so I think it's very important that there be a serious debate about how we can and should proceed in Afghanistan. I am personally of the opinion that the reasons that we got into Afghanistan, not only September 11th, but overall state failure and instability in the region, require us to remain engaged in Afghanistan in a robust way. I think that abandoning Afghanistan as we did during the 1990s is far more problematic than remaining engaged. That said, our strategy for engagement over the last couple of years has not yielded good results. And so there are a few fundamental things that I believe we need to do to shift how we approach Afghanistan in order to make it more successful.
And to what extent are we hamstrung by the what came out of our original military intervention? In other words, in order to take down the Taliban as quickly as it happened, essentially the warlords were organized with a handful of special forces and suitcases full of cash, etc. And it was a remarkably successful operation, but the legacy of it is apparently that you've got that warlord component still there. And many people tell me that the problem for the poor, hapless Afghani citizen is during the day you get brutalized by your government, and during the night you get brutalized by the Taliban.
I think that's absolutely right. We are living with the legacy of, I think, some very bad short-term decision-making in terms of how we've addressed Afghanistan. This reliance on the warlord militias, the very same militias that caused the devastating civil war of the 1990s, that made Afghanistan so unbearable to the population that they welcomed the Taliban, these are in many ways the same people who ended up in power around the country after the fall of the Taliban. And we bear the legacy of that. You know, as many people said about Vietnam, that instead of one 10-year war, it was 10 one-year wars. And I think we're starting to see that same problem in Afghanistan, that our policy has been short-sighted. It hasn't looked to the long term in Afghanistan, both in terms of what was realistic to achieve, which is very important, but also thinking about doing things in the near term and what their consequences will be in the long term. And so the fact of relying on people who clearly don't abide by the rule of law, who committed grave human rights abuses in the 80s and 90s, essentially meant that our strategy was going to be in the hands of people who didn't support our strategy. And we have to find a way to undo that, because one of the primary problems that it's caused is not only that these people behave badly, but that they've actually caused the population to lose confidence in the Afghan government and in the democratic process, because people sacrificed. In those first few years, people felt that there was hope, and they sacrificed and they took risks and they raised their expectations. And then what they found around 2004, 2005 was that the central government wasn't something that they trusted, something that they felt that they could rely on. Not because the central government itself was necessarily bad, but the central government was allied with these warlords. And so their predation on the population subsequently has made the population relatively more neutral. In other words, they don't love the Taliban, but they also don't love the government, and they feel squeezed in the middle.
Well, you, Alexander, worked on the Afghan study group co-chaired by General James Jones, and I imagine since General Jones is the president-elect's national security advisor, he's obviously totally up to speed with what you're saying. Of course, with so much on Obama's plate, starting on Tuesday, hitting the ground running, I imagine somewhere in the back of his mind, he's thinking, you know, I've put down my marker on Afghanistan, but at the same time, I don't want to end up like LBJ and have this be my Vietnam. And, you know, I've got so much on my plate already. I don't want this to become a millstone. So am I making stuff up, or is this a reasonable narrative?
Well, I think that's absolutely right, but I think that the response of the Obama administration in its first 2 years is going to be to take a very aggressive approach to try to deal with the problems that we're facing in Afghanistan, as opposed to pulling away from it. So a few things that we're seeing. One is the dramatic increase of American forces over the next year, possibly doubling the size of the American contingent in Afghanistan from a little over 30,000 to as many as 60,000 forces, which is a huge investment. And of course, General Petraeus, who's now the CENTCOM commander, will be somewhat responsible for the approach that those forces take. So that's a big plus up in how we're dealing with Afghanistan from a military perspective. At the same time, it looks all but certain that Richard Holbrooke is going to become a special regional envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan and other countries in the region. And he's going to attempt to not only deal with Afghanistan and the shaping of Afghanistan policy, but in fact looking at Afghanistan through a regional perspective, because so many people believe that the only way you can deal effectively with Afghanistan is by dealing with some of the regional problems, particularly Pakistan, where the Taliban do still have sanctuary. But if you look at Pakistan and the reasons why they provide sanctuary to the Taliban, then you have to look to India and so on. There's also the Iran question. And so having a regional envoy is a way to take a much broader and more in-depth perspective. That's the second piece. And then the third piece is actually going to be funding. President-elect Obama promised an additional something like $1 billion in foreign aid for Afghanistan from the United States. In addition to that, Vice President Biden, together with others in the Senate, proposed a bill to increase our funding to Pakistan in terms of civilian aid, not military aid, by another $1.5 billion a year. And so there is also a big plus up in the amount of investment of resources in development that we're planning on sending to the region. And so we talk about the three D's of foreign policy: defense, diplomacy, and development, and all three of those are going to receive a boost in the region. So they are clearly thinking about a robust strategy to try and turn things around, as opposed to a strategy that looks at how to minimize our role there.
So are you suggesting, Alexander Thier, that there could be a kind of a big-picture approach through Ambassador Holbrooke? In other words, you can't have peace in Pakistan unless you have peace with India, and you can't have peace in Afghanistan unless you have peace in Pakistan.
I absolutely think that's right. That is the concept behind the regional envoy. We recommended this in the study group report with General Jones over a year ago, and precisely for this reason, because the stability of Afghanistan is so connected to its region. It's always been that way. You know, Afghanistan was the heart of the great game, this regional competition then between the British empires and the Russian empires. And then we saw this again throughout the 80s, where you had the Americans and the Saudis and others with Pakistan on one side, and then you had the Russians invading on the other side. And so it's always been this battleground of regional competition, which is so fundamentally destabilizing to a country that's landlocked and very poor and lacking resources. And we still see that Afghanistan is deeply affected by this regional competition. And as a result, there needs to be a regional perspective on how to resolve it. And I do think that while there are many negative regional dynamics, competition between the countries, the opium trade, these are all regionalized problems. But at the same time, there is an enormous potential for enhanced regional cooperation. Trade is one of the biggest issues. One of the reasons that the Pakistanis supported the creation of the Taliban in the 1990s is because the promise of the early 1990s was the opening of Central Asia and the reopening of a land bridge between the subcontinent and Central Asia, the Middle East, and Europe, something that everybody in the subcontinent had dreamed about essentially since the Soviet Union had swallowed up this territory and blocked it off. And so there's an enormous potential for trade and energy projects through the region that have still not been able to be brought to fruition because of Afghanistan's fundamental instability since the opening of the Soviet Union. And so there's enormous potential for enhanced regional cooperation on trade, of course, regional cooperation on fighting the narcotics issue. And so I think that there are concrete steps that could be taken in this time that would allow these countries to work better together and to enhance their interdependence in a positive way so that they're less interested in destabilizing Afghanistan and more interested in stabilizing Afghanistan.
Well, just in closing, Alexander Thier, I have a brother who's a foreign correspondent who was just in Afghanistan with the Australian contingent there, and the Australian soldiers refer to themselves as armed social workers. And I'm wondering whether there'll be a policy shift at the very top here in terms of the relationship between the State Department and the Department of Defense. Even senior people like Gates, the Secretary of Defense, have suggested that the nation-building role that the military has got to be, the State Department have to step up. And, of course, we know from the sorry history of Iraq that, in fact, in both cases, we've had quick victories followed by slow defeats because we've never delivered on the civilian side. So is there going to be some kind of reorganization here where the State Department takes a greater role in nation building?
Well, this is an issue and idea whose time has definitely come. I mean, you would have a hard time finding anybody in the U.S. on the diplomatic side, on the defense side, that doesn't agree with that. But fundamentally, this role needs to be a civilian role. It needs to be done by civilians. It needs to be led by civilians. But the perennial problem that we face is that the military has all the men and all the money. So when you look, for instance, at this idea of a troop increase in Afghanistan, you're talking about something like 30,000 new troops. And the State Department is talking about maybe 300 new people. So 1% of the number of troops that would go in would be matched by this civilian surge. And on top of that, they're not even sure how they're going to be able to find 300 civilians to go and work in the wilds of Afghanistan. You know, we can basically make our military go into these places, and they're used to understanding that they're going to work in very dangerous environments. And of course, there are many civilians who are willing to do that kind of stuff, but relatively limited. And so we have to find ways both to increase the funding for civilians and to increase the manpower that the civilian agencies have to bring to bear. And that is not an easy task. It's something that several have worked on for the last couple of years. They're talking about having a sort of reserve, a civilian reserve, like we have a military reserve. And there are different ways of going about this, but we have yet to tackle that beast. And my concern is that despite the fact that everybody agrees that this should be far more in civilian hands than military hands, the truth is the military has the funding and has the people to send to Afghanistan this year, and it remains to be seen whether the civilians do. So I hope that idea will be met with resources in reality. But I think those of us who have watched this process over the last several years remain somewhat skeptical about our government's capacity to make good on that promise.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Alexander Thier.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Alexander Thier, who's the director of the Future of Afghanistan Project and senior rule of law advisor at the United States Institute of Peace, where he co-chairs both the Afghanistan and Pakistan working groups. Thier was a member of the Afghanistan study group, co-chaired by General James Jones and Ambassador Thomas Pickering, and was a member of the Pakistan Policy Working Group. And he's also the director of Project on Constitution Making, Peace Building, and National Reconciliation, and the leader of an expert group on the Genocide Prevention Task Force, co-chaired by Madeleine Albright and William Cohen. The study that he's referring to here, The Future of Afghanistan, is available free online at www.usip.org. And many of the people that contributed to this study are very, very well-connected and knowledgeable, including Ali Jalani, who was the interior minister of Afghanistan from 2003 to 2005, where he quit in disgust because of the fact that Karzai's brother is one of the biggest opium dealers in that country that is beset by the opium trade. I'm now speaking with Dr. Trita Parsi, who's the president and founder of the National Iranian American Council. His writing has appeared in numerous publications, including The Guardian, Haaretz, The Forward, Huffington Post, and The Nation. Dr. Trita Parsi worked for the Swedish Permanent Mission at the United Nations in New York, where he served in the Security Council and handled affairs for Afghanistan, Iraq, Tajikistan, and Western Sahara. He also served in the General Assembly's Third Committee addressing human rights in Iran, Afghanistan, Myanmar, and Iraq. His most recent book is Treacherous Alliances: The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. And Dr. Parsi, obviously the role of Iran as a sponsor of Hamas is greatly exaggerated. It seems to be going under the radar that, in fact, Hamas begged Hezbollah to intervene to take some pressure off them, and Hezbollah didn't. So why is it that our press faithfully reports this notion that Iran is manipulating events in the Middle East?
Well, I think it's somewhat similar to the phenomena that we saw right before the Iraq War. In order to be able to justify an intervention into Iraq, an occupation of that country, the Bush administration had to come up with a large number of justifications, none of them which later on turned out to be true. But a common theme was to portray, of course, Iraq not only as a bigger threat, but part of a different and a larger threat in order to be able to justify the invasion on the grounds of the war on terror, essentially trying to link Iraq to al-Qaeda. If you could link Iraq to al-Qaeda, then suddenly it would be perceived as so much more justified to go into Iraq. A similar phenomenon is taking place right now in Israel's assault on Gaza. If you want to be able to easier justify essentially a bombing of a refugee camp, you sell it by saying, well, this is part of a larger threat to the Middle East because of a connection between Iran and Hamas. Even though the Israelis oftentimes do bitterly admit that the real problem with Hamas and its funding is not coming from Iran, it's coming from Arab states, particularly Saudi Arabia. And that Hamas, actually, since it is more of a nationalist Palestinian Sunni organization, has been quite reluctant to develop its ties with Iran further. The extent to which they are developed seems to be out of necessity because of a lack of other options and not because of an ideological inclination towards turning to Iran.
And last week on the program, I spoke with Avish Shlaim and with Uri Avnery, the peace activist, and both pointed to the irony that if Iran has any traction and influence in Hamas, it's because they provide social services. And of course, the question then begs, why don't the Israelis provide these services? I mean, in that election between Fatah and Hamas, it was a choice. The Palestinian people had a choice between voting for the mafia or voting for the Salvation Army.
That's one way of putting it, certainly. And I think the corruption that does exist and continues to exist and seems to have even gotten worse in Fatah is going to maintain Fatah as a rather weak entity. So if it is the leading, if it is the party that is leading the Palestinians, it will be a very weak party that one can easier impose solutions that otherwise would not be accepted by the Palestinians. I think in a way Israel may be chasing a pipe dream here, because it's going to be much easier to actually have a sustainable solution with an entity that is more representative of Palestinian wishes than one that is so dependent on Israel or on the United States or any other entity, Iran included. I think another factor that is important to keep in mind in all of this is how this is potentially going to be influencing or impacting Barack Obama's intentions of being able to pursue a new Middle East policy in the region. This polarization, this increase of tensions is only going to make it more difficult, I fear, for Obama to pursue a new Iran policy, and may even, at worst, fence him in, trap him in a continuation of the Bush policies precisely because of the polarization.
But surely, Dr. Tridipassi, that is it is reasonable to speculate that that was the motive on the part of the Israeli government. Obviously, Tzipi Livni and Ehud Barak are trying to head off the possibility of Netanyahu winning in the elections that come up in a couple of weeks. They're in effect killing thousands and wounding thousands of Palestinians in order to prove that they're man enough to stand up for Israel. But last week I also spoke with the former CIA officer Robert Baer, who pointed out that he thought that what was happening here was that this was in effect a consolation prize for the neocons and the hawks in Israel who wanted to attack Iran's nuclear facilities. And according to last week's New York Times, the Bush administration, obviously under pressure from our own military, decided it couldn't be done, and they wouldn't give the Israelis the bunker busters. So as a consolation prize, Bush and the neocons said, okay, go ahead and here's your consolation prize, beat up on Hamas.
There's a lot of speculation of why Israel would choose this timing for such an operation. Bob's theory, I think, is a very interesting one. And, of course, you mentioned that there may very well have been an intention on Israel's side to make it more difficult for Obama to pursue diplomacy. In Tehran and in Lebanon, there seems to have been a fear that this may have been some sort of a trap, a hope that Hezbollah or Iran would intervene in the last 2 weeks of the Bush administration's reign and essentially expand the war, and that would make it much easier to justify a military operation against Iran on its nuclear facilities if Iran or Hezbollah had begun to interfere in the war in Gaza or open up a two-front war. So there seems to have been a lot of various forms of motivations that may, if one speculates, been behind the Israeli action. I think the least credible one, though, is what some Israelis are saying, that this was aimed at restoring Israel's deterrence. I don't think there's any deterrence that is being restored by essentially bombing a refugee camp.
So do we have to put this down then to at least the neoconservatives are consistently wrong? In other words, the beneficiary of the their project in Iraq has been Iran, and the extent to which Iran may be the beneficiary, as they were apparently, or at least Hezbollah was in the last summer war in Lebanon. There's a feeling that the so-called Arab Street are disgusted with their own governments. Now, clearly, the notion that we're discussing here, that it's erroneous to suggest that Iran manipulates Hamas when Hamas is a creature of the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood. I think what is really clear, isn't surely, Dr. Parsi, is that this Israeli action has made Fatah look cowardly, weak, and irrelevant. It has the Egyptian people seething at their own government, and therefore making opposition, the underground opposition, which apparently is very popular, the Muslim Brotherhood, more powerful, and perhaps gives them more of a potential taking over. It undermines the Jordanian king, whose population is 60% Palestinian and are seething. So at the end of the day, this could be more about being counterintuitive on the part of the Israelis and putting in jeopardy the two peace treaties that give them real security, the Camp David Accords and the peace treaty with Jordan.
Well, the neocons do definitely have a near-perfect record of being wrong. I would caution against the thinking, though, that this in some way is benefiting Iran. It is true, as you said, that the sentiments on the Arab streets are as high as they possibly could be in opposition to their own dictatorial governments, particularly the sense, which seems to have some foundation, that the Egyptian government actually was in on this and was collaborating with Israel in the attacks on Gaza. But I would be cautioning against thinking that this some way somehow automatically translates into a benefit or an advantage for Iran. Certainly, Iraq, Afghanistan have done so because of the neocon mistakes, but it was always indirect. And in this specific case, I think the Iranians are very concerned about the situation because what they do not want to see right before Obama coming into office is an escalation of tensions, which would then complicate Obama's ability to pursue diplomacy with Iran and would also increase tensions between Iran and the Arab states, whose passivity is actually needed by Iran in order to make sure that they don't start meddling or undermining U.S.-Iran diplomacy. So in many ways, at least in the short run, I think the Iranians are probably quite concerned about the situation and do not necessarily see this as automatically benefiting them, even though public sentiments on the streets in the Arab world tend to be more positive towards Iran because of its stance and far more negative towards Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Egypt because of their stance.
And Dr. Trita Parsi, what's happening inside Iran? The cracking down on the part of the Ahmadinejad regime on the Nobel laureate Shirin Ebadi and her colleagues, the two very, very prominent AIDS activists, the brothers, who were doing really good work for AIDS prevention in Iran, to the extent to which it was almost a model for the rest of the third world countries to emulate. It seems to be that there's something irrational going on here. Is it that Ahmadinejad is in a state of panic? His budget was predicated on oil at over $60 a barrel, when of course it's way down now and likely to stay down. There's a possibility of Khatami running again in the next election. So give us a sense of internal Iranian politics playing out in this situation.
Well, I think there's a couple of things we're seeing. On the one hand, you're quite right. When tensions in the region increase, the Iranian government has traditionally utilized that opportunity, as they see it, to clamp down on internal dissent, on internal pro-democracy forces, pro-human rights forces. And what has been done against the Nobel Peace Prize laureate is, I think, in many ways a warning, not just to her, but to everyone else in Iran, essentially saying, if Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, cannot be safe in Iran, then who can? So it is an intimidation campaign. Now, Azadeh Mouavini, an Iranian-American journalist who writes for Time Magazine and Wall Street Journal, published a very interesting piece in which she argued that part of the reason why the Ahmadinejad government may be targeting Shirin Ebadi in such a manner as they are right now is because they may be hoping that she will call for a boycott of the upcoming elections. She called for a boycott of the upcoming elections in 2005 when Ahmadinejad won. And a lot of reformists are arguing that her call for a boycott was actually decisive in giving Ahmadinejad the victory, inadvertently, of course, because the people who would follow her recommendations are the ones who would not have voted for Ahmadinejad. They were people who voted for other candidates. So canceling out those votes really helped Ahmadinejad, and it may be so that they're hoping that they can provoke her to make such a call once more, which then the Ahmadinejad government would calculate, would help them in the upcoming elections. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's an argument that shows how complicated things are in Iran and how difficult it is to read the Iranian political scene, mindful of the lack of diplomatic relations that exist between the United States and Iran. We have so little insight into what actually is going on in Iran politically.
And what about the reemergence of Khatami? Is that?
Well, Khatami, there's been a lot of speculation, and he has given indications that he may be interested in doing this. It's a very interesting case if he were to run, but he's already made it clear that he would only run if he will get some sort of consensus from other players in Iran, particularly the supreme leader, that if he wins, he will be able to reign and rule and not be as constrained as he was during his two earlier mandate periods, in which there was a significant amount of disappointment in him failing to deliver on many of his promises. Much of that was because of opposition from conservatives, but I think in retrospect it is also quite clear that a lot of it was because of Khatami's own lack of courage and ability to push back. Having seen how Ahmadinejad has governed in the last couple of years, I think it's been quite obvious that if you are quite audacious, you can get away with a lot of things. And Ahmadinejad has managed to get away with a lot of things in Iran's internal political system, precisely because he pushes back all the time and he tests the limits. Khatami was very cautious about testing the limit. And I think for him to have a chance to win again, he needs to prove that he is this time around capable of pushing the limits, because I don't think a lot of people would turn to him if there are other candidates available, if he is not capable to prove that the next 4 years will not be like his previous last 8 years.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Tridipasi, in terms of the neocons being consistently wrong and the extent to which this attack on Gaza is their sort of last hurrah, if you will, and clearly their involvement in the fiasco in Georgia again was counterproductive, not the least of which is the pipelines supplying oil and gas to the West are now in jeopardy, and you can see how much control Putin now has over this squabble with Ukraine in terms of supplying his domination of the market in Europe. And, of course, the air base that they were planning on using, the Israelis were planning on using in Georgia to attack Iran is probably in jeopardy. But the neocons and the hardliners in Israel are not going away. So what do you expect in the next few years in terms, and particularly if Iran does move towards a nuclear weapon and there's some evidence to that effect, what do you expect will happen?
Well, one word of great encouragement came from President-elect Obama about 3-4 days ago, in which he, in an interview, said that he is inclined, or I think his actual words were that on day one, he would be starting to pursue a comprehensive peace in the region. That would be a significant break from the past, because in the past, many of the old Clinton advisors in his circle are still arguing to try to manage the conflicts in the Middle East instead of trying to resolve them. And I think the last crisis now, the one in Gaza, has helped convince President-elect Obama that if he only tries to manage conflicts, he will be constantly at, he's going to constantly be taken hostage by whoever wants to create problems in the region. And his agenda would, in essence, be controlled by others, not by himself. If he, however, pursues a much bolder policy and actually tries to resolve issues, and the fact that he used the word comprehensive, I interpret to mean that he recognizes the linkages that exist between Iran and in Iraq, Afghanistan, Israel, Palestine, Lebanon. All of these issues are linked, and you cannot resolve any of them piecemeal. You have to be able to resolve all of them, not necessarily at the same time, but you have to recognize the linkages. If he does this, if he pursues this, and if he manages to get regional actors, the Europeans and others, to come along with this, then I think actually we can see a quite different history and future for the Middle East than we've seen in the last couple of years. It's going to be admittedly extremely difficult, but I think more and more people in Washington are realizing that it is the only way. These type of managing of problems or piecemeal approaches simply help fuel further escalation and tensions.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Dr. Trita Parsi. He's president and founder of the National Iranian American Council. His writings appears in numerous publications, including The Guardian, Haaretz, The Forward, Huffington Post, and The Nation. I'd like to thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.org.